the naked truth. Truth. Truth.
If I were to name a theme for my dating experience, I would say it's been like a hot mess express.
Well, guess what? That ain't the way it works.
I was in my manic episode. I took a medication for depression, and it was like completely sent me into psychosis.
I struggle with fear all the time. I'm actually afraid of a lot of things.
That discomfort as a sign that there was something really amazing in front of me.
But when we hang up, my inner critics would be like, what did you say? Or did you do that right? Or do you really want to share this podcast or not? And, you know, and it's all bullshit.
Truth. 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 Truth.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Naked Truth. I'm your host, John Cohen, as always. And it's a steamy August night here in Flagstaff. And I'm excited about my guest. I've known him for several years. He's a friend of a friend kind of thing, a fellow adventure biker, motorcyclist, been all over, and currently residing in Baja, Mexico. And he's kind of got the wanderlust thing like I do. He's gone a lot of places, has a very interesting story, and I thought it would be kind of cool to have him on today and have you guys kind of get a little window into his story, because I think it's quite an interesting one. So, Steve, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. Living in Mulegé down in Baja. I was up early this morning. It's been quite a journey to get to where I'm at, but today was an extraordinary day. I was up early. Met up with a friend, went out, caught some mahi-mahi, came back, did some work, took care of some stuff, made some dinner for some friends, went to a meeting this afternoon, and now just eager and anxious to share some of my adventures and some of my story. I think there's something here for everyone.
That's awesome, Steve. I appreciate that. Yeah, and I'm always curious and fascinated by the backstories of people like yourself, the adventurers, as we say, who just love to, like, you know, seek new pastures and see what's around every corner and just keep moving and stay in motion. And I think, you know, I think our stories will probably have some parallels, I'm going to guess. I was rooted for a very long time in one place that I did not like. And, you know, ever since I cut that cord, I've kind of just grabbed everything. So, let's start at the beginning with your story, Steve. Like, where did you grow up? And a little bit about what your formative years were like, you know, when you were, say, elementary school, middle school. What's your memory of that? And talk a little bit about mom and dad and all that kind of stuff.
Sure. So I think you lived in Ohio. I did, too, when up until the age of seven. My dad worked for Amoco, and he was managing an independent operation in Kettering, Ohio. And when I was seven, we moved to Salt Lake City. So I'm from the Midwest, but landed in Salt Lake City at age seven, and it was a very interesting experience. I'm not Mormon. Was raised Catholic, Catholic upbringing, and a Catholic kid in Salt Lake City is definitely there's a tension there, and there's, you know, there's a discomfort of not being part of the group. And I think that's not just a situation in Salt Lake City alone. I think that's anywhere. You know, you could be maybe, an Irish guy in Little Italy in New York City, just feeling kind of out of place. And the Mormon culture is a very inclusive culture. And that created a lot of, you know, discomfort for me. So formative years, my dad was a former Marine. High school dropout, joined the Marine Corps, went to work for Amoco, ultimately became one of the most successful executives, general manager of an operation in Salt Lake City named Rainbow, which wound up being the most profitable business unit in Amoco. So very successful businessman. And when I was young, my mom tells me, I mean, I don't remember this, so I had to be 5 years old or less. She said my favorite shirt was a shirt that said Free Spirit on it. And, you know, she still laughs. I'm very close with my mom, and she still laughs. She's like, you are that free spirit. She's got four kids, and I'm the one that likes to wander. So, growing up in Salt Lake, you know, my dad and I, there was some tension there because I think he saw me as a lost kid, you know, that if he didn't instill some discipline in me, he thought I'd probably never eat. And he may have been right, because I was, you know, I was pretty carefree. But it was in Utah, you know, started skiing, had season pass a snowbird. So I was skiing every weekend, moved over to Alta years later, started hitting the backcountry. And really, Utah's where my sense of adventure really manifested and just took a hold. It became really what my soul is about. And my soul is about two things. I've done a lot of discernment. And the two things that really jazz my soul are adventure and being of service to others. And, you know, that really kind of came to be, the sense of adventure especially came to be in Utah. And so I went to the only Catholic high school in the state of Utah back in the 80s. It's named Judge Memorial. And it was less of a Catholic high school. It was more of a non-Mormon school. And it created a very tight community because of, you know, this place we were in. We're all non-Mormon in Mormon Rome, if you will. So the connections were great. And that's where I met a lifelong friend, Ruben Jimenez, mutual friend of ours. And, you know, Ruben and I, we met when we were 14, and we still text every day. Talk a couple of times a week, and just super, super close. But it was also during my time in Utah where I developed a certain affinity for alcohol. And unfortunately, that manifested into something really negative later in my years that required me to deal with some stuff.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great kind of getting us ramped up to the meat of your story, I guess. That's a good backdrop. And I just wanted to say that the way you described how you felt in Salt Lake, I think I felt like that in Ohio for different reasons. I never felt like I fit in my family. I was adopted, as many people know, and I had great parents, but you know, I didn't look or I wasn't like anybody in my family. So I kind of went through the same thing, and I really never liked Ohio. Like, all my sports teams were anti-Ohio. Like, whoever the rival was my favorite team, you know, pretty much. Like, so I kind of felt misplaced, you know, and I think, like, that's what I hear you kind of talking about, although you did grab onto the – I didn't have the outdoor stuff. Like, I didn't have the playground that you had in Utah, and that's part of the issue was, you know, Ohio isn't a playground, an outdoor playground by any stretch. So I think we have that common in our story for sure.
For sure.
And,
for sure.
And I did not go down the alcohol and drugs road at all in high school. I did nothing, you know, private all boys, 12 years. I discovered that more when I got into college. But pick up your story where you kind of discovered alcohol and then kind of take it from there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, before I go into my alcoholism, you know, the wilderness and the playground that Utah and the Wasatch Ranges became a refuge. But sadly, you know, in high school, it was a party school. You know, it was highly academic. It really helped me to form, you know, my capabilities to go and become a successful professional. But, you know, when we weren't really working the books, you know, it was pretty common. We could get together and there were parties and it was a pretty festive, you know, situation. And, you know, as an alcoholic now, I realize, you know, it's who I am and it's not who I became. It was a part of who I was from the beginning, whether it be drinking or just the alcoholic mindset. So really kind of started getting into it in high school. And, you know, that's where I can look back now and see the pattern really began. And then the pattern just intensified as I got into college, had more freedom, got pretty wild, was drinking quite a bit. But, you know, it was, you know, fraternity parties and, you know, it was fun. It was cool. But as we say, you know, alcohol is your best friend until it becomes your worst enemy. And it's strange, but I think even then I can go back to memories and say, yeah, you know, I got a problem here, but it isn't affecting me. And I was a functional alcoholic for many years. And there were periods of time where in my 30s, I wouldn't drink. I'd have a 12-pack of beer in the fridge downstairs for 3 months and not finish it. So, you know, alcoholism isn't just about just absolutely, you know, drinking every day. I mean, that's what it manifested for me. But it is, it's a mindset. It's the compulsion to drink. And it's, you know, so my path to sobriety was the 12 steps. And, you know, the step one is you're powerless over alcohol. Your life's become unmanageable. Well, I was always kind of powerless over it, but it didn't really consume me until later on. And there's certainly a story around where that took me and how I found myself at my bottom. And then from there, where I rose from there, man.
So where did you go to college at, or did you go to college?
Oh, yeah, yeah, man. I have a degree in international economics from the University of Utah. And while I was working at the going to school, I ended up taking a job at the University of Utah Medical Center as a phlebotomist, man. And this was an amazing job. I was, you know, drawing blood, which is a fairly rudimentary role or task within a hospital, but it took me into, you know, a very high acuity hospital trauma center where I was going into burn units. I was seeing traumas being flown in on helicopters, neonatal ICU. And boy, talk about a way to see life and to see how precious life is, as well to really start to understand humanity. I remember this is during the late 80s when AIDS and the AIDS epidemic was really prolific. And going into a patient's room where he had the, you know, the markings from AIDS, and he was terribly sick, and he was dying, and his partner was with him. And, you know, growing up in a conservative household in a very conservative state, I had a certain mindset around just people, you know, same sex marriage or partners of that nature. And boy, that was a turning point to say, you know, my job in this world is not to judge. My job is to love. You know, judgment is a coming from a place of fear, it's coming from ego and those types of things. And seeing this man suffering and seeing his partner there and the remorse and the pain in his eyes. And I can tell you 1,000 stories about like that, working, you know, at the University of Utah Medical Center, as well as, you know, pursuing a degree in economics. And I did a lot of coursework in finance as well that led me into a great professional life.
So you get out of college, you graduate. Did you graduate with a good GPA or mediocre?
It was mediocre. You know, it was, I don't know, somewhere around 3.0, probably a little lower than that. But, you know, what really was manifesting there was, you know, my dad instilling me the American dream. You know, the American dream is get the degree, get the job, get the house, get the wife. Three, you know, the kids, the dog, all that shit. And really what happened for me, and I did that. I mean, I've got a ton of energy. I'm characterized as a type A driver by those that work with me. And I think a lot of that was just instilled in me from my dad. And, you know, I thank him for that. I've got a very strong work ethic. But the American dream ultimately became the American nightmare for me because I became consumed and so driven to achieve and to go. But that's also indicative of an alcoholic, right? I mean, one's not enough and 30's too many. Well, you know, I've done nothing half-assed. I've skied over 1,000 days. I've run rivers 500 days. I've now ridden 180,000 miles on a motorcycle over 6 years. So, yeah. You know, the same thing played into my professional life. And ultimately, that led to a very bad place, man, a very dark place.
So you get out of college, and your GPA was better than mine. We'll just leave it at that. and you roll out of college and you start working at the medical center. And how do you get out of Utah, or do you get out of Utah? Or did you kind of just, you know, stay there for a while and go through a few jobs? So kind of pick up the story from there.
Yeah, so I get out of the University of Utah. I've got this clinical, you know, hospital experience, and I've got a degree in economics, which is really, you know, with a lot of business. So, you know, the natural path for me, and I did an internship at a medical device manufacturer. So I went into medical sales. I started my own independent manufacturers rep group, was selling medical devices in Utah. And, you know, that young, the first job out of college, I was learning from my own mistakes, which is very expensive as a sales guy. So I took a job as a medical sales guy in Kansas City, lasted 18 months away from the mountains and just went nuts. I remember telling my then wife, I felt like my soul was dying. So I then got over to Colorado, took a job that really led to my career path to this day, which is product management. And product management, the highest level to describe it is like you're the CEO of a product, where you're accountable for the revenue and the margin for a product group or a product itself or a service. And the idea with that is you take a concept, you work with development and engineering teams to develop it, you work through the legal partnerships, whatever, marketing, customer agreements, then launch it, train salespeople and support deals. And that's been my career path for over 30 years now. But yeah, I mean, it led into a degree of work experience that led into a career path of medical sales and product management. I left the medical business and moved into high tech and telecommunications. Was a product manager in video conferencing devices and services for about 30 years. And then these days I'm working on some other stuff. But yeah, that's really kind of where it went out of college.
So you mentioned a wife in there somewhere. So tell us about that, when you met, how long you were married, and kind of what's your recollection of how that marriage was for you?
Sure. I met my ex-wife. I was just before I turned 21. I was working at the hospital. She was a nursing student at that time. I was a phlebotomist. Saw her, you know, real pretty, really intelligent. The woman had a scholarship for both piano and nursing at the University of Utah. Highly intelligent. She was raised Mormon. Really wasn't that connected to the church. I was Catholic. You know, I'm like, well, here, you know, this is a path forward. And a bit of that in the naiveness of being that young, that, you know, I could help her, maybe help build some confidence. My observation, my experience with the Mormon culture was that they didn't treat women really as equals. And, you know, I could see where, you know, maybe providing her some confidence would help her manifest into something pretty incredible. And she got her nurse practitioner degree, and ultimately she had enough strength to get out of a marriage with a guy who wasn't in a good place. But you know, I was married 23 years. I was with her for 25 years, and boy, we had some great times. She loved to fly fish. A woman could fish. She could take a fly rod with a headwind, and she could punch through that wind and put the fly exactly where we need to go. And what we were doing is I got a guideboat for fly fishing, and we were running rivers every weekend. I was guiding her. The dogs were running around. I was on the oars, and logged about 500 days running rivers with her and with friends. I never got paid, but I was essentially a fly fishing guide. And that was a passion for a long time. But again, that compulsive alcoholic behavior, right? I don't do anything half-assed. So, you know, it wasn't, I did a little fishing. I said, no, 500 days running rivers and everything.
Did she ever give you an ultimatum to like, hey, get some help or stop drinking or whatever?
Yeah, there were some times I'm very regretful, and I've done some amends around it. It's a living amend for me to ensure that I never return to that type of behavior. There were some situations where, you know, frustration manifested into anger, manifested into really, you know, rage. And my behavior was totally unacceptable. And there were some extenuating circumstances with the work I was doing, the amount of work I was doing. But, you know, I own my side of the street, and I can only say, you know, the way I treated her was not right. And I've told her that. And, you know, we had a lot of good years, a great marriage. And I don't like to talk too much about it, but, you know, I've got a daughter and a brilliant, brilliant girl with a great adventurous spirit, too. And, you know, from there, I mean, blessed with a wonderful, wonderful, you know, a relationship with Melanie for those years, daughter that's really rocking the world. And, So, you know, marriage, I've done a lot of adventuring, and I've been on the road a lot, but I've always known that, the real gem for me, where I like being in relationship, emotional intimacy is really what resonates with me. It's who I am. And, you know, I saw my time on the road as, and we'll talk about that, but my time on the road, I knew that when I found the right person that that's where I would be.
Right. And so you go through and you get divorced. When is your wake up call of, all right, I need to get my shit together and stop this? I mean, when did that happen and how did it happen? Like what happened in your life? Yeah.
Right on, man. So, you know, toward the end of our marriage, I was working for a company named Avaya, a big technology company that does network infrastructure and applications for IP networks. And with my background in video conferencing, they had acquired a company named RadVision out of Israel, and no one was really stepping up to represent the business. They were looking at this integration as just kind of technology, product codes, that kind of stuff, ordering systems. And I said, hey, guys, you know, you really need someone to represent the business side of things, the sales organizations, the channels, and the customers. So I became the point person for that. And what that meant, though, is I had to be on video conferences with Israel 5:30, 6 in the morning. Then I'd meet with Europe, then the East Coast, the West Coast, and a couple of nights a week I'd be on with Asia Pacific, you know, 9 to 10, 9 to 11. And if you could imagine that type of work, I mean, I felt like I was under pressure. I remember telling Melanie, I felt like I was in a vice that was just continuing to compress. And, talk about emotionally unavailable. I think I was probably the textbook definition of that. The pressure, everything was leading. And then my drinking had started to, you know, accelerate. Then, you know, Melanie left. And shortly after that, I felt like, hey, I'm free. I can just drink all I want and, you know, kind of be a 20-year-old that I've never was. And it was a short time that alcohol was my best friend and then quickly became my worst enemy. And I was drinking really, you know, powerless over alcohol, step one there, right? Yeah, that was me. And so she had left, and I was trying to work things with my cell phone, ended up just getting a new phone and phone number. And I reached out to our friend Ruben, and to call him, let him know I had a new cell phone number. Got to talking with him, and he was in a bad place, just from some life things going on with him. And I was, obviously, man, I mean, I'd gotten laid off from the work I did on that integration. I received the President's Award, which was really a milestone in my career. And it was a time where I'm like, okay, I've done it. I've achieved what I wanted. And then 18 months later, I got laid off. And like 20 months later, the company filed for bankruptcy. So part of it was probably me, but part of it was the business situation. So now I'm not working. I've got a severance package, I got unemployment, and I'm just sitting, just drinking myself, essentially drinking myself to death. And I made that phone call to Ruben, and I remember telling him, you know, Ruben, this is not a conversation we should be having over the phone. This is a conversation we should have in person. He was living in Ojai, California, and like 24, 30 hours later, I was at LAX, he was picking me up, and we just went to his cottage there in Ojai, and there was this tree. I remember I love Dave Matthews, and one of his songs is The Dreaming Tree. And I named this tree, this Dreaming Tree, because it was there. I was drinking, trying to hide it from him. We went to a movie, and I remember telling, you know, Melanie used to tell me I was a narcissist. I said, Ruben, am I a narcissist? This is a guy who's known me since I was 14-year-old. He said, no, Steve, you're not a narcissist. You know, you care about people. But then we were going to a movie. I was talking about fly fishing. I was drinking, and I just had, you know, diarrhea of the mouth. And Ruben's half Mexican, half German. And he's got that kind of flattened fire in him. And when you push the wrong button, you know it. And we get to this restaurant, and he looks at me with this look in his eyes like, Steve, that was narcissistic behavior. I was trying to talk. I was trying. You wouldn't give me space. I was trying to participate. He's also a therapist, so he has, you know, this vernacular that he uses, and kind of in that regard. And that night we went to a movie. The next morning I woke up and I said, Ruben, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And his response was classic. You think? And right. And then the most beautiful thing happened, man. I detoxed. 3 days, the first 3 days are the most dangerous, man. That's when I could have gone into an ICU and that, and this person in my life is so beautiful. He checked on me every hour, you know, through the nights for 3 days to make sure I checked and see if I was shaking and that. I detoxed, went to my first meeting in Ojai, California. Then like the next day I flew back to Colorado. I was living in Colorado Springs at the time and just hit it hard, man. I haven't had a drink since. I had no relapse, and thank God, you know, hopefully, you know, I'm an alcoholic, but working my program every day. But I was going to mass every morning and meetings 5-6 days a week and in the evenings, and just did some real deep work. And that's where I did the discernment and really dug deep to discover and figure out who the heck I am and who I am, what makes my soul vibrate. And I delineate, you know, happiness is that thing in my head, that little dopamine drip, right? Where I buy a widget for my motorcycle, you know, oh, that's great. But joy is what resides in my soul. So I've really discerned what brings joy to my soul. And again, it's adventure and being a service to others. And now that's really what my focus in my life is about.
So how long ago was that, Steve, that you went to your first meeting and stayed sober?
June 4th is my sobriety birthday. And this last June 4th was 7 years. So 7 years without a drink. And man, how life has become amazing since then.
Wow. Congratulations, man. I know I work at a program here in Flagstaff, and I work with recovering addicts. And, you know, I've heard their stories. And boy, what tenacity and dedication it takes to stay sober and to change really a lifestyle that you've had for a very, very long time. So great job on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Gracias, amigo. And I tell you, it is a bitch in the beginning. It was hard, man. And thank God I had Ruben, because, he, you know, we talked every morning and I was helping him with some stuff. He was going through and he was checking in on me, and, you know, it was difficult, but there's all these cliches in AA. And it's funny, you know, you go in the first time and you're like, oh, brother, whatever. And, you know, now I look at the cliches and they're still right. And one of them is the highway just gets wider. And that is exactly the case with me. The highway has gotten wider and wider and better and better. So I as crazy as it sounds, I'm almost grateful that I'm an alcoholic, because it allowed me to really dig deep and face the demon, look in the mirror and get honest with myself. And then with that honesty, you know, make the changes. And now I almost look for areas where I have fear or insecurity so that I can go resolve those and continue to grow. And again, and as I continue to grow, the highway gets wider, the opportunities, the experiences just get richer and richer.
That's awesome. That's great. And so when would you say you really like said, all right, I'm just going to wander and, you know, hit the highway and get on the motorcycle and just really, you know, I know you've lived in several places. You've lived in Cortez. You've lived in where else? I know I'm forgetting some places.
I was in Ojai, man. Those are the two places I really lived.
Yeah.
I was near Ojai. Yeah.
It seems like you were wandering out more than that. I don't know why it feels like that. But you and I have met up several times, and you know you're in a different place, and I've moved around a lot as well, but. So how did that decision, like, you know what, I'm going to try this and I'm going to try that. I remember you were in a hotel room in Cortez, and, you know, which is, there's nothing more non-permanent than that, a hotel room.
Actually, the hotel was in Colorado Springs, but yeah, man. So I was working through some stuff, and my dad had passed away, and I had taken care of my mom, and then my dad had Alzheimer's and he passed away. And I was homeless. I was living in a vacant office in a motorcycle, you know, business in Denver, and got a LinkedIn message or something from a recruiter for Verizon, took a job with them in Colorado Springs. So I went from homeless to making a decent living. So I had to be in Colorado Springs. I had to report into the office, and I was living out of a hotel there. And looking for an apartment, and then the pandemic hit. And I'm a contractor in a pandemic. I'm not going to sign a lease. I mean, they don't have to take me through an HR process to, you know, downsize or whatever. So I just kept living in that hotel and, you know, recovering alcoholic in a pandemic. And there was some crazy stuff that went on there. It was a quality hotel. It was a Econo Lodge there. Owner and manager was a really good guy, but, you know, his occupancy had really gone down. So he had to take in some state funded, pretty sketchy people. And there was a situation where a guy just went off the rails in the room next to me. He was loaded on meth. He was drunk, you know, just bad situation. And we had to call the cops. And at that point, my family, you know, my siblings and that, things weren't going that great. And I'm like, you know, if I can work out of a hotel in Colorado Springs, I can do this anywhere. So it was June after the pandemic really hit. I hit the road and had a GS850 that I picked up right before the lockdown. And I was doing a lot of riding and loaded up and took off, went over and spent some time with Ruben in Park City. And then from Park City, headed over to Crater Lake and up the coast, spent some time in the San Juans, and wound up being a year living and working from the road off my GS. And about half of that year was living, you know, staying in hotels, Airbnbs. And the other half was living or sleeping nights out in my tent, which is my preference. And then hitting a YMCA, I got a YMCA membership so I could shower up and really transition from outdoor Steve to business Steve. And, you know, get shaved and everything. And my deal was if I had to be on a video conference in a minute, it had to be ready to go with a professional backdrop, quiet, not working from picnic tables and campgrounds and that kind of thing. So I would hit a YMCA or a truck stop, get a shower, get into a co-working space, which was great, you know, and would work from there for the day. And God, I think over that year, I think I traveled over 50,000 miles on my GS. And I went from essentially Colorado to the Pacific and from the Mexican border to the Canadian border. And there's some stories around there that I shared on Facebook. But yeah, it was a year on the road. And then I just, you know, so part of the 12 steps is giving your life over to the care of God as you know him. So for me, that I've totally surrendered, which has been great. But my deal is I got to keep my feet moving. You know, the analogy of a bicycle, you know, God can't, you know, steer a bicycle that isn't moving. So I keep my feet moving, but I really let go of the handlebars. And those, you know, the universe has worked her magic, man. Put me into people's lives. I've shared about my recovery, my sobriety, and my journey on Facebook. And there were times where people would reach out to me and say, hey, you're in the area, you know, I'd like to meet up. And they, you know, they recognized they had a problem. They want to start working on it. And other times people came into my life. At that time, I was 270 pounds and I'm 5'8", man. I was a big boy. And there was a wonderful woman in Albuquerque that I met up with. She's a medical doctor, brilliant woman. And she shared with me a keto diet and, you know, kind of what that process was and really opened her pantry, taught me about it. And then I landed in Cortez. I was just mentally, emotionally, physically exhausted. I take on a lot of people's energy. I'm pretty, empathetic, or I'm an empath. And, you know, combination of that, sleeping on the ground, riding, you know, I was traveling a lot. The combination of all those factors, I reached out to my friend JJ in Cortez, and he knew of a place, top floor of an A-frame home, beautiful views of Mesa Verde and Sleeping Ute Mountain, and spent 10 months there until my contract with Verizon wrapped up. But yeah, it was amazing. And then once that contract wrapped up, that's when I took off and made a trip up to Alaska.
What is it about the motorcycle, do you think, that appeals to people like us? You know, because it's, you know, I don't think it's an accident that, you know, we're kind of wanderers or have been at least part of our lives. And we are kind of gravitate towards this thing that has two wheels and an engine, and you're completely vulnerable and exposed to the elements. Like, what do you think it is? What do you think the tie-in is there, like, of the motorcyclists that you've met, the adventure bikers? And for those who don't know what adventure bike is, if you've ever seen those bikes with big boxes on the sides, that's an adventure bike. It can go pretty much anywhere. You can go on the street. You can go to a trailhead. I own one, as does Steve. And so, Steve, what do you think that is the draw there?
You know, it's difficult to explain. But, I mean, there's a freedom that goes along with it, but there's also the risk. And, you know, adventure to me is about taking risks and overcoming and achieving. And, you know, sometimes the greatest adventure is exploring a new perspective in religion or something, you know, because that's taking a risk outside of your comfort zone. And for me, the magic happens when I'm outside my comfort zone and I'm pushing myself. And I mean, I had a deal. I rode over the pass and it was just brutal. That's down in the San Juan Mountains on my 850. Now I'm on a 1200 GS. And the next morning, you know, it was lined up traffic because of the fall colors. People were watching on I-70. So I grabbed a room in Glenwood Springs. Was up at 3 o'clock in the morning so I could be in Boulder at a co-working space by 8 o'clock in the morning. I remember that was like early October. I went over Vail Pass at 5 o'clock in the morning. It was 19 degrees. And for me to, you know, stay with traffic, I was going 60, 70 miles an hour. I don't know what the wind chill is, but I'll tell you this, it was cold, but I loved it, man. I was testing myself as hard as I possibly could to remain cognitive and, you know, physical. All of it was right there. And I wound up having this incredibly productive day. And that happens on a motorcycle where, especially an adventure motorcycle, and you're, you know, crazy guy like me that looks for those types of opportunities. You know, that's where I'm so far outside of my comfort zone. I'm discovering who I am and what I'm capable of. And from there comes a resiliency and a formidability that, you know, it's the highest sense of achievement for me. And there's no crowds. There's no one, you know, cheering you on. This is just me, the motorcycle, and going. And there's a freedom that goes with it. You know, the day before I was, you know, it was 19 degrees on Vail Pass. I was on Ophir Pass with the fall colors, really challenging myself on the bike on some really difficult terrain, and doing it and making it and achieving it. And for me, the motorcycle is that. It's the vulnerability. It's taking the risk, it's overcoming the risk, the sense of achievement, and the physical, mental challenge that comes with that. And then the feeling afterward is like, wow, I just did that, man. I just made that happen.
I think it's that, and I've done Ophir Pass, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Not on a bike, I did it in a car, but I think it's like, can I do this? Like, am I capable of doing this? And I had the same experience in Canada recently where I had, you know, 35 miles of dirt to do to get to a trailhead. And then I had this, you know, epic hike, one of the best of my life. And, you know, that was, you know, 5-6 hours. Like, could I navigate by myself? And I don't even know how to change a tire, by the way, on a motorcycle, which is, I should probably learn.
Might be a good idea, buddy.
Yeah, thanks. And like, can I get there, do this epic hike by myself? I mean, this is grizzly country here, you know, by myself, hike this very, you know, sketchy hike, and then ride back on this road where anything can happen. Anything can go wrong. You know, it's like you have that question mark. Can I pull it off?
Yeah.
You know, and then you pull it off. And then, you know, like you're saying with Ophir Pass and all that, it's almost like, wow. And it makes you feel like alive, you know, in a sense.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's a great way. I've never felt so alive. And there's been other times, you know, skiing and doing some backcountry routes and stuff, but you know, the motorcycle, yeah, man. I mean, you just feel like at the end of the day, your body is like vibrating with energy, with like electricity. And I got to think the bio, you know, neurobiological process there is just peaking. And it's like, I did that, man. I did it. And what you're talking about is way cool. And that is starting to combine activities, riding and hiking. I'm now riding and, you know, snorkeling and, you know, mixing these activities. And, you know, it takes it to a new level.
Yeah, and I think the vulnerability too, because when you're on a bike, you're vulnerable to everything, all the elements. You know, I mean, you got a suit of armor on, but still. So I think that's also part of the risk, as you described it. Talk about your, because one of my dreams is to go to the Arctic Ocean on a motorcycle, and there's two ways to get there. There's the Dalton Highway in Alaska, which, you know, I want to hear about your experience on that, and there's also, what's the other one in Canada called?
This is a Dempster.
The
Dempster that goes
Dempster.
up to Toyotuck, yeah.
Yeah, the Dempster. Talk about your experience riding up to through the Dalton Highway in Alaska and what that was like for you, because you know, going to the Arctic Ocean on a motorcycle is pretty epic. Like, it doesn't get much better than that. So talk about that.
Yeah, man. So I was in Alaska a total of 2 months. I had booked a ferry from Whittier down to Bellingham. So I was pretty much stuck there for 2 months. And I grew up in Utah where it's 300 days of sunshine a year, and then Colorado is much the same. And I found myself in Girdwood, Alaska, where it's a rainforest, one of the furthest north rainforests. And it was gray, it was rainy, and it was, I could deal with cold, but I found the greatest challenge for me in Alaska was I found myself in seasonal depression. Thank God I've got some therapist friends I could talk with or say, look, man, my mindfulness work isn't helping here. And they're like, dude, you need serotonin. It's this is not just a mood disorder. This is like some clinical depression in that. So I'm in Birdwood. I was house sitting, for a couple of weeks there. I'm going getting cabin fever. I'm like, I got to get out and go. I'm heading up. I'm gonna try to make it to Prudhoe Bay in the Arctic Ocean. So I found myself over in McCarthy, down to Valdez, then bolted up to Fairbanks, spent the night there. It was a rainy night, made it through. And the Dalton is really challenging if it's wet. If it's dry, it's pretty fun. But when it's wet, I think it's sodium chloride that they use to treat the road, and it turns to grease. So I left Fairbanks, and it was rainy, but it looked like it was breaking up. And it was 150, maybe 200 miles that I made it up to the Arctic Circle. And my plan was to camp there, maybe continue on. But I was pretty tired because it was greasy. When you're on these big bikes, you have to stand the whole time to be able to manage them and maneuver the bike and just control them. So I was standing for hours in that grease, and it just worked my body. So I made it to the Arctic Circle off on the Dalton, got my picture at the sign, great campground there. And I found myself just seriously challenged. And the next morning I woke up, it was 32 degrees and snowing. And one of the truckers said that Atikan Pass up north was whiteout conditions and snow. And on a motorcycle, that's just not. I just don't do that, So the furthest north
Right.
I made it was the Arctic Circle. And talk about a sense of achievement. Yeah, because I mean, physically, I did it. I had done a lot of training. I went from 270 down to 185 in terms of weight. So physically, I was conditioned, was strong. My skills had gotten to the point where I could handle a very difficult road like that in those conditions. And mentally, I was in a funk. And I overcame that, man. And now I look at life and I'm like, I got other challenges. I can face them, pretty confidently. And it was epic, man. Just a little bit of a side story. I'm in my tent in the Arctic Circle. And I don't know if it was maybe magnetic energy or there's energy vortexes, but I'm sitting there listening to some music on my headphones, just resting. I could feel this kind of strange flow. And I put my hand up, and my hand is literally moving like a wave. And it was just like some magnetic or vortex or something. It was the craziest thing in the world. But it was also one of those treats you get by really pushing yourself and finding yourself in a very remote, beautiful place. And after a day that really challenged me,
Wow, that's all. That's amazing. Such an amazing story. Are there any other stories on a motorcycle where that come to mind for you that were transformative in any way? I mean, that's a pretty big one. I don't know if you can top that, but is there anything else that kind of comes to mind?
The other big one, there's a gal, Laura. I met her through Facebook. I went with her and her dad riding. They live on the western slope in Montrose, and it was overpass, man. And I'm riding up on there. I've got my camping gear. I was planning to camp the night and then head out from there back, you know, to Boulder as I need to be. So I'm riding up overpass, man. And it's a scree field and it's loose. And I've got kind of a street oriented rear tire on. I've got a knobby up front. And I'm just going, you know, and I'm like, hey, I got to just go focus and do this. So I'm riding up. And just good momentum and everything. And I get up to the scree field and there's Jeeps coming down. So I have to stop and wait for them to pass, which was just messing with my mind and my confidence. So they clear, I get going and my rear tire just augers in like it was sand and ended up burning up my clutch. And her dad pushes me out, gets me going. I get up on the foot pegs, I get going, I get to this turnout and I made it, but my clutch is like toast, you know, I'm barely engaging. So I wait for them and I'm in the switchback and then I got to hit the top section. And again, minimal clutch, I get going and it's really kind of rocky and loose. And here comes another Jeep. I'm like, boy. So I stop there, wait, they pass and I get going again. I get going like 10 feet and my glasses fog up. So I can't see. And I'm going through the most difficult part of overpass, the top section. And this guy, Laura, said it was hilarious because I should just see the top of my bike come up and then go down and a bunch of rocks would fly up and then it'd go up. But I kept the bike moving, which is what you have to do. You have to use the physics, the centrifugal force to keep the bike standing up and moving. So I get up to the top and I'm like, I just made it. Awesome. I got bad knees from when I was skiing. And I go to get a picture next to the sun. I step on a rock and my knee dislocates. I get it back in. I'm sitting down. And I'm like, that was one of the most awesome days of rides in my life. And then the next day, I end up going over Vail Pass at 19 degrees, man, wow. Watching the sun come up. But, yeah, I mean, those are things that I do. You know, I'm not afraid to push myself and I've got really good gear. I've got great equipment. I got a great bike. I've got skills, and you know, finding what I'm made of is part of my sense of adventure. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's amazing, and I do know what you mean. And I've had some of those moments as well. And it's funny that the times where it's nice out and sunny, you don't remember those times, but you remember the ones where they're challenging and there's you know, inclement weather and all these challenges. So now, present day, you're in Mulegé, Baja, living there, and you've been there for several months, I believe. And
yeah, I've been here since May.
Yeah. And so talk about life there as you know it. And I'm going to say this is not your final stop because, you know, many people say to me, I hope you find what you're looking for. And I'm like, I hope I don't. Because if I do, like, I'm going to stop, and I don't want to stop. I want to keep going and exploring and grabbing and experiencing as much as I can. So you're there for now. This is your stop. Talk about what life is like in Baja.
See, man. So first, I came over the border. Well, I took a week off, came down to Baja. Just my you know, approach to travel is I'm always prepared. I mean, I've got half a pannier of tools, compressor, tubes, you know, whatever I need to do what I can to get that bike going again. Always prepared, and I never plan. I let the universe work her magic. And so I took a week off from work, came down, wandered around Baja, found myself visiting a friend near Mulegé, stayed on this beach for 3 nights, and I'm like, I have to live here. So I went back. I mean, I'm quite a minimalist. So literally everything I own fits on the motorcycle in two boxes. So I just packed up. Landlord was cool. Let me get on my lease. And I came down here, and you know, the reason I had to be here was it's beautiful. There's beaches, some of the most beautiful beaches in the world. You know, I'm now into snorkeling. Today I was out fishing for Dorado. There's those types of adventures, but really it's about the people. And My view is human behavior originates either from a place of fear or a place of love. And there's so much fear in American society these days. It's sad, man. And from fear comes greed, comes ego, comes all the things, selfishness. And what I find here is people act from a place of love. These people take care of each other. If you're kind to them and respectful as an American, as a gringo, they respond in such a warm and kind way. I think I always have a place here. But from here, I see myself traveling. I'm thinking of, you know, heading down to Todos Santos, you know, maybe next week. And, you know, from here, I can get over the mainland. I want to do some hiking in Peru. I've been thinking about the Himalayas, doing some riding, some hiking there. But Mulegé, the Mexican word I love is tranquilo. It's tranquil. And it is. There's a peacefulness. There's a kindness. There's a warmth of these people that I've never experienced. And I've traveled all over the world on business. So I've been to places and I've done my travel on the motorcycle. But I found something here that is very, very congruent with who I am and what I desire as part of, you know, the community I reside within. That being said, I am something. I'm an adventurer, and heck, my ancestors are from Czechoslovakia. I'm pretty sure they were gypsies. So I'm a bit of a gypsy nomad, but I got to have a home base now. I got to have a place where I can come back and just rest, recuperate, recharge before, you know, the next chapter goes. And the next chapters are going to look different, I think. Not just motorcycle, but, you know, hiking. Now I've got the fitness. I can do some of those things, the snorkeling, you know, doing some spear fishing, you know, just kind of exploring this whole new world, which is the ocean. The first time I swam in the ocean, and I've ridden the ocean, you know, from Baja to the Arctic Circle, all along the coast. The first time I swam in the ocean was last April on that trip. And now I've discovered this new world, and I'm like, wow, this is a whole new place for adventure and exploration. And now catching Dorado, which is mahi-mahi, you know, catching that and making it, made dinner tonight for a couple of guys from fish I caught a few hours earlier. That's a great adventure too. So adventure, I think, is something that's amorphic for me. It doesn't just fix. It's not just one thing. You know, it was skiing at one time. It was running rivers at one time. It's motorcycles. Now I think it's motorcycles and it's about experiencing this amazing world, whichever way, you know, that draws me, the universe takes me. And I hope I can encourage others to just step out into the world, get out of the cave, into the world, and just feel it, man. It could be a walk to the mailbox. It could be a hike in, you know, whatever it is, man. But stepping out into that place and allowing the wilderness and Mother Nature to work her magic is, man, that's what it's all about to me.
I agree, man. And just burns me up when I see people that are just not living their fullest life and they're just, you know, stuck in, you know, mediocrity and accepting of that. And it's just really, you know, I just really want to shake them. And like, you have no idea what's on the other side of that, but you just got to put yourself out there a little bit and take a risk, because, you know, just doing the 9 to 5 and whatever. And there's always reasons to not, you know, like grandma's getting old or whatever. I mean, there's always reasons, but you know what? You got one life and you got to live it. There's no do-overs. And I think, you know, you're a great example of somebody who's, you know, taking it by the horns and is, you know, doing everything they can to squeeze every drop out of life. And I think, you know, you're not living the traditional lifestyle. And I was raised very much similar to you, where it's like, yeah, white picket fence, 2.5 kids, you know, that whole kind of thing. And I never fit into that either. So it's nice to meet a fellow adventurer. And Steve, I just want to thank you for your time. And I want to ask you where people can find you and follow your story, because you have some really great posts on both Facebook and, you know, you write some great stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Facebook. I think Facebook is a publishing platform, and it's where I can go and share my story. So my posts are like three paragraphs, and then I'll do, you know, it's like a 15 minute read. You know, good pictures with telling the story, the people I meet, the places I've gone. And if ever anyone has an interest in going someplace where I've been, I can send the GPS coordinates for a location. I'm always open. I've been given a gift, and I'm very, very, I feel awesome if I can share that gift with anyone. So Facebook is the best place to track my story. And, you know, I'm continuing to work that. I'm working on an ebook for my Facebook post, to put it together a little bit more cohesively. So the story's going to continue to grow and the adventure's going to continue to grow. And I'll tell you, my two favorite words, kind of going back to what you were saying about kind of stepping outside, my two favorite words are why not? You know, why not just step out there? And there could be a good reason. You know, I have to take care of my wife. She said, okay, no. But if we start out with the phrase, why not? Then all of a sudden it's like, well, why not? Why not jump on my motorcycle and ride from Colorado Springs to Ojai to go to an investment banking meeting? Okay, you know, I got the time, I got the means, and that turned into a lifestyle that's been epic. About 180,000 miles now over the past 6.5 years on a motorcycle. Now from the tip of Baja, Cabo San Lucas, all the way to the Arctic Circle. And, you know, hey, why not?
Why not?
Why not go out, live, love, and just thrive, man?
I love it. I love it. Steve, so it's Steve Sida. If you want to follow him on Facebook, S-I-D-A, really enjoy his stories on there. And if you want to subscribe to The Naked Truth, please find us anywhere podcasts can be found and hit that subscribe button. Give us a 5-star review. We'd always appreciate that. We're looking for a new sponsor. We're no longer sponsored by Toyota. Tough times in the car industry. You know how that goes. I still love my Toyota regardless. But Steve, you've been a great guest. You've been very vulnerable, transparent. I really appreciate it. And I will see you somewhere out on the road.
Yeah, brother. I hope our paths cross again soon, and I'd love to host you and share some of my my experiences here in Mulegé and Baja with you, man. So let's make it happen, right?
Why not?
Why not? Exactly. Exactly.
This has been a Naked Truth production. Because this is such a raw and truthful show, you may be experiencing some of the following symptoms: heart palpitations, shortness of breath, fever, nausea, dry skin, vomiting, clammy skin, fainting, dizziness, and rash. If you experience any of these, please get medical help immediately. Thank you for listening.